Stephen Fry is an actor, screenwriter, author, playwright, journalist, poet, comedian, television presenter, film director, and a director of the Norwich City Football Club, and he's been declared a British national treasure. He's written and performed in BBC programs like Blackadder, Jeeves and Wooster, The Sketch Show, A Bit of Fry and Laurie, all of them with his friend Hugh Laurie, also in films like V for Vendetta, and in recent years he's hosted the panel quiz show QI. He visited us in January to talk about the second volume of his autobiography called The Fry Chronicles, in which he picks up the story of his life at university and goes on to his early and prolific successes. Listeners told us that they really enjoyed our conversation, so we thought we would play it for you again today. I began by telling Stephen Fry that I'd read that he'd said being interviewed is like being mugged, assaulted, and raped. And I asked him, so should I feel honored that you've agreed to come back to our show for another go-round?
I'm not taking this as an interview. I'm taking it as a conversation.
Oh, so you're not carrying any mace there?
I was referring to print interviews, which I don't do. And I haven't read a newspaper for about 7 or 8 years, and I haven't done a print interview for a very long time. It's one of the reasons I so adore Twitter, is that if you have nearly, in my case, 4 million followers, it's like having your own newspaper. So you don't have to have some resentful swine filtering what you say. You can say what you say. People can listen to me talking to you and decide that I'm not someone they like. They can think I'm a pompous ass. That's entirely they're right, because they're listening to me. But when it's filtered through a journalist who's chosen, you might offer someone, I've done it literally with a journalist in my flat. I said, do come in, like, have a coffee. I said, the moment I arrive, I see that he tries to turn on the charm. You think, oh, for
but
heaven's
sake. That's British newspapers, isn't it? People are paid to be snarky.
It's certainly true in Britain than it is in America. And I know I saw that documentary about the New York Times, and it saddens me that it's dying and that Deadwood Press is dying. But it's a fact. It is. And there's no good, you can't get away from it. But that doesn't mean that news is going to go away. Things are going to stop happening. More people listen to the radio now than have ever done in the history of the medium since Marconi first sent his message. It wasn't superseded by cinema, and it wasn't superseded by television. Things complement each other.
But you're really almost born for television, because you can give us that raised eyebrow and that wry smile, and people will know that a joke is coming, whereas sometimes when you're reading something in print, it gets totally lost. Nuance gets lost.
I suppose it does. I think that's the fault of the writer. I think the odd thing is, I could argue that what you're saying is actually completely untrue, and that something like Twitter is proof of it. Even within Twitter, where you can't so much as use italics, unless there are, someone will ring in and say, yes, there are sort of cute little Twitter clients which allow you to use weird symbols and things. But generally speaking, you're using vanilla ASCII text with no ability to do any form of bold or any form of sarcasm font or anything of the nature. And you can instantly read it in 140 characters. Indeed, there are algorithms. In Hollywood, as you know, movies open on a Friday, and by the time the Sunday ends, they're adding up the box office, and that matters. That's a movie's opening defines the success of the producer, the director, and, of course, immediately the star. How did that movie do that weekend? They now find through Twitter, through analytics of Twitter traffic, that by the Tuesday before the Friday opening, they more or less know with one or two percentage points how it's going to happen. And they have sarcasm algorithm readers. They know when people say, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to see that movie, they know that's sarcasm. So the fact is, you don't need to waggle an eyebrow and pull a face in order to exhibit humor. You can do it by choosing words well.
Have you liked being on the other side of the interview table? When Steve Jobs agreed to be interviewed by Time magazine, didn't he insist that you be the interviewer?
Yes.
Is that because you were his best customer?
In some ways I had been his best customer, one of his evangelists. I shared his vision, but it was his vision, not mine. He was a visionary.
You laid out a lot of money.
Which I'm glad to say, because some people think that I was a shill who was just given all the equipment. But no, I've spent hundreds of thousands on Mac equipment ever since it came out. I mean, I bought the second ever Macintosh computer sold in Europe January the 25th, which is almost 2012, so whatever it is, almost 24 years ago. It was like the scales fell from my eyes. I saw that this was the future, and he had seen it. Of course, he didn't invent it. He wasn't a code writer. He wasn't a soldering iron man. He wasn't an engineer. He wasn't a businessman. I didn't even know if he could read an account balance sheet. But that's why I say the only word you could use of him is visionary. Really, he saw things. He saw how they were going. He saw more than George Lucas what our movies were going to be made. So he didn't invent the CGI movies that the Toy Story became. But he saw that that's how it was going to happen. So he put together Pixar from under George Lucas's nose. And I liked him. He was not a man I would like to have worked for. He was an ornery, difficult man, because he was stubborn and his way had to be the only way. And I'm not a confrontational person, and I can't take insult. But as a companion, he was charming, and his influence on my life as well as the life of millions of others.
I do want to get to the book, but I also am curious about how you came to interview Lady Gaga.
Well, she was the other one. Yes, I don't interview people. Time magazine asked if I would do the. It was for the release of the iPad, the Steve Jobs one, because Steve had turned down just about everybody else they'd suggested, and he suggested me, which gave me rather the whip hand when it came to negotiating with Time. In the other case, the Lady Gaga one was someone from Penguin who published this book, The Fry Chronicles, in England. The Penguin Group also owns the Financial Times, and I was doing a book event, and the head of Penguin, John Makinson, was there with a friend of his who worked for the Financial Times, and she said, "Could I ever persuade you to write for the Financial Times?" I said, "I don't write for newspapers at all. I'm afraid if I wrote anything, I'd write a blog or my own website or I tweet." She said nothing, and my partner, who happens to be absolutely nuts about Lady Gaga, said, "But if Lady Gaga." You'd do an interview with her, wouldn't you? And I turned to him and I said, "Oh, you swine." I said, "All right." As it happens, 2 weeks earlier, we'd been in West Hollywood, and I'd been at the Soho House West Hollywood, which is a club, and my friend, the director, Brian Singer, had been there, and he said, "Oh, look, there's Gaga." And my boyfriend went into a kind of frozen rictus of, and it was just bizarre, because he really does worship her. He said, "Let's go and say hello." And so I had to drag my boyfriend.
You don't judge him harshly.
No, I think she's a genuinely talented and extraordinary woman, actually. I really do.
No, I meant your boyfriend.
No, I don't judge him harshly, because I think he has good taste. I think she is remarkable. She has the Rilke quotation tattooed on her arm. I'm not saying having Rilke tattooed on your arm is the sign of an intellectual and someone worthy to
be worshipped.
But you have Nietzsche on your butt. That's much more sensible. But incredibly, it turned out that she did arrive in London, and she consented for me to interview.
Now, this book covers relatively few years of your life. Mm. It takes up where Moab Is My Washpot left off.
That's right, which was more or less prison. I'd had a very, very...
This begins at a rough time and ends at another rough time, but these seem to be the relatively happy years.
They are, and that's... It almost worried me, because the point about the first book, Moab Is My Washpot, is it was a childhood memoir, and I think anybody can relate to a childhood memoir, because the only real context of childhood is parents and, there may be differences in class and income and ethnicity and so on, but essentially childhood is a unique republic to which we've all belonged at one point. And mine was a very stormy childhood. There was a more Sturm and more Drang than you could possibly hope for. I was expelled from a lot of schools, and I ended up in prison and so on.
Why did you go to prison?
It was credit card fraud. In fact, it was theft. I'd run away from home, and I was spending my last few shillings on a pint of cider in a pub and it was cold, and as I left the pub, I noticed a coat hanging on a hook, and I just took the coat and slept on a bench in a park, and when I woke in the morning, I found there was a wallet in the coat, and there were two credit cards in it, a Diners Club card. Did they still exist, Diners
mm-hmm.
Club?
I think so.
You don't see them around as much, do you? All due respect to Diners Club. And they had the signature on. It was the days before the magnetic stripe. It was the old roller machine, And I looked and sounded sort of respectable. I was 17. I looked up beyond my years. And I stayed at the Ritz Hotel, and I went on a numerous series of absurd journeys around Britain, spending money that wasn't mine. Eventually got caught up with, went to prison.
So what happened? Was prison what transformed you? Because the next thing, you wind up going to Cambridge. There are an awful lot of – and you teaching as well. It seems to me a lot of people weren't paying much attention. Did they even know that you'd had this experience of prison?
No, because it's the kind of thing you ask. I seemed like such a normal product of the English private school system. I seemed so.
It's a matter of class.
I seemed so tweedy. My
the
voice,
right accent.
I had the apparent authority and ease and confidence that upbringing gives. Of course, I had none of those things, and I'm not wholly those things. The two most British people you can think of are, in fact, half American. Winston Churchill and Agatha Christie each were half British and half American. I always think that's worth remembering.
And now we have Meryl Streep.
My father is English and British as a rice pudding and Yorkshire pudding, but my mother's from a Middle European Jewish family, and I think most really, really British people are actually a mixture. But the fact is, I was given 2 years probation, and it was my mother, to be honest, visiting me in prison. I know it sounds sentimental, but we have this very, very cryptic crossword, the Times crossword. It's very difficult. It's very different from your New York Times crosswords, which are very easy. They have immensely complex things they do with the words, which make them quite a sort of, you know, favorite of Oxford and Cambridge professors.
Puns
and
anagrams.
But yes, and so forth. And I used to love doing them. And my mother had cut out about 60 of them. And she visited me in prison, and she'd got permission to push them under the little thing, the little guichet. And it was that made me break down, and I thought I owe them something. So I studied on my own and got a scholarship to Cambridge and arrived at Cambridge University. And of course, nobody at Cambridge said, "By the way, have you been to prison?" It's not a question you ask the average student. And I fully intended to grow tweed in a corner quietly and become an academic, because I got a scholarship, and I got the top scholarship on Shakespeare, and Shakespeare was my passion, and I thought I would become a Shakespearean scholar.
Stephen Fry's latest book is The Fry Chronicles, an autobiography. Well, this book ends. It's clear at the end of this book that the next one will begin with your addiction to cocaine.
Yeah.
So this is these are the happy years. But the first sentence of this book is, "I've got to stop saying I'm sorry."
Yes.
What are you always apologizing for?
I don't know. I'm apologizing for my good fortune, for the fact that things seems to have slipped so easily into my lap. I spoke about prison. As soon as I arrived at Cambridge with this scholarship, I almost very, very quickly, one of the first people I met and became very close friends with, I'd seen her being in a play. I thought, God, she's amazing. And I found that we had the same seminar on A Winter's Tale once. We were wandering along, and I introduced her. I said, I saw her in that play last night in Travesties. She was called Emma Thompson, and we became very, very good friends. And
is that where you met Hugh Laurie?
Well, that's eventually she introduced me to Hugh, because there's a famous comedy club at Cambridge called the Footlights, where, you know, Peter Cook and John Cleese and all the Python, most of the Python people, and everyone had been. And it's extracurricular. You have to understand, it's so different from the American system. Nothing you do outside of your exams counts towards your degree. You know, there are no grade points for doing acting or anything like that. It's all entirely off your own back. I wrote a play in my second year, which happened to be a comedy, and she took Hugh to see it in Edinburgh, because he was there doing the Footlights show. And I don't really remember. I remember this person coming up and going, "Hello." And I went, "Hello." And that was sort of it. And then at the beginning of our last year, she said, "Let me take you around to see Hugh again." I said, "Who's Hugh?" She said, "The chap I introduced you to in Edinburgh when you saw your play. He's now the president of Footlights, and he needs someone to write with." And I arrived, and I remember, and it was love at first sight. Fortunately, not of the erotic kind, but of the collaborative comic kind. We just sat down at it, we started writing sketches, literally that minute. I mean, Hugh's girlfriend was in the corner with a glass of wine, and Emma was sitting together just looking at us, thinking, what on earth has happened? They just saw this extraordinary locking. It was like two, you know, creatures just locking onto each other. And we just had this instant rapport. I was very fortunate.
And collaborated on a lot of wonderful things. But are you surprised now how well he does an American accent?
Not in the least, because he always did a great American accent. I was
that he's an American TV star?
I'm not surprised simply because I've always known how talented he is. And also I'm not surprised because I know his concentration level is so high. And it so suits him. I'm not saying this because I could do it, because I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it for a number of reasons. I'm not as talented, probably, and also I couldn't do the same thing.
But he probably couldn't be years. The. He couldn't probably do the QI, which is the most esoteric quiz show in the history of the world.
Nor would he do two documentaries and write a book and do a comedy series in three films and present a series all in 1 year. It would drive him mad. What he does is for 9 months of the year, every single day, he gets up very early in the morning and he works for sort of 14, 15 hours. And that's his life. And then he gets a three-month hiatus between seasons. Now, that takes a certain kind of absolute dedication and a certain just cast of mind, if you will. And I don't have it. I would just be bored, rigid. By the time I was in the middle of the second season, I would probably insist on their writing a script where House put a gun in his mouth and pulled the trigger, because I would say, I'm out of here. I'm surely you've seen enough. But in fact, I love watching House. I mean, I get a season pass every year. And you can't believe it. He says, you don't really watch it, do you? I said, I honestly do. I love it. I think it's brilliantly written. And I sort of forget it's you. He's my very best friend. We spend every Christmas together. We have done ever for the last 30 years since I've known him. And his children are my godchildren, and I adore his wife, and we're just very, very close. But I'm so proud of him. And now that he's added music, which is another huge talent of his, he's produced this album, this blues album, which I think was very brave of him to do, and it satisfied him deeply as a huge part of him.
Well, what we learned about you here is that you're an addictive personality.
Yes.
And it seems to begin with sugar.
That's right. I've sort of divided the book rather sort of cutesily, you might say.
Your grandfather brought sugar to Britain, is that true?
By pure coincidence, it's true. There's no sugar beet, no endemic in Britain. All the sugar we had was either from honey or it was imported from the West Indies cane, from the slave trade, I'm afraid, or from Australia. Somebody in the 1920s and early 30s thought, look, if there's another war in Europe, it'll be a bit like the First World War, where the Atlantic was nearly cut off, and maybe there'll be no sugar. Maybe we should learn to grow it. And in Hungary and places like that, they grow it using this strange thing that looks like an enormous sort of white carrot, a sugar beet. And so my grandfather, who was a Jew from what is now Slovakia but was then Hungary and then later became Czechoslovakia, it's been through all kinds of changes, was actually the manager of the largest sugar refinery in the world, in this place, Szczyrny, which had a large Jewish population. And his brother-in-law, Robert Jorisch, was the scientist in it. And they were invited by the British government to come in the early 30s and teach the British to grow sugar. So my grandfather, who'd always been an Anglophile, said, sure, if it come, I thought, well, that'd be lovely, fantastic. And he just got married to his cousin, as it happened, who was a Jewess from Vienna. And so they arrived, and he became a British citizen by 1936. So it was that good fortune that allowed me to exist, because the rest of his family was slaughtered by the Nazis, or those that didn't escape to Israel or New York, at least. But it was a lot of them. I know this because I did one of those British programs, Who Do You Think You Are? I believe the format has transformed to America now, I believe, as well. You know, where you follow your family tree. And, of course, all of us with Jewish blood, I'm afraid, it very often ends up at Auschwitz, and that's what happened with a lot of them. But so he brought sugar, and yes, being an addictive personality, to me sugar was everything.
A gateway drug, and it began with sugar puffs.
Exactly that. Began with sugar puffs, and I would buy packets and packets and eat them out of the packet like someone eating popcorn in a cinema. And then the village shop was like a jewel shop in this boarding school. I was sent away when I was 7 years old to a boarding school hundreds of miles from home, which seems very cruel and peculiar in Harry Potter now, but that's how things were. And
cut off from sweets? Contraband
there was
sweets.
A tuck shop, which is tuck is an English private school slang for sweets. And you had a small amount of pocket money allocated, but of course I always got through mine in the first 2 weeks. And that's where I learned to steal in order to feed my habit, which was sugar. And then it became cigarettes. And then I end the book with taking my first line of cocaine, and I'm afraid which everyone's going to go, oh God, another showbiz person talking about his fight with
Well,
drugs.
You're past all of
I'm
that.
Gonna, yes, I'm past all that, but I'm going to try and make it amusing. I'm going to try and make it interesting. But my friend, the writer Joe McInerney, he went by me saying this is his own history. Of course, is one that he's made a terrific career out of.
Well, you were celebrated.
I told Jay, I said that I thought that I might begin my next book by having just simply a list of all the places I had taken a line of cocaine, like a bathroom in Buckingham Palace, the gents in 10 Downing Street, in the White House, in this place, list all the places where, because when you're a coke addict, you find a men's room and you take a line in it, and if you're lucky like me and you know people, then it will be in palaces and castles and prime ministerial residences, and it sounds like showing off. It isn't. It's a peculiar thing, and I know some people get very, very sort of rather sententious about it and talk about addictive personalities and it being a disease. It may well be a disease. I think we probably have to reinvent the word disease if we honestly want to call it a disease. But it's certainly an affliction, a disorder, I think is probably the best word. I have an addictive disorder, something that makes me cling on to things. And that has driven my life.
But it also could have led you to theater.
Yes.
Which can be seen as an addiction.
Oh, completely. And showing off is an addiction.
In fact, you mentioned the playwright Simon Gray is one of the legendary smokers you've met.
Hmm.
You said that he didn't have an alcohol problem. He had an alcohol solution.
Yes, that's right. he was a lot nastier when he wasn't drinking.
Well, you had a very well-known incident where you left the theater in which you were performing one of Simon Gray's plays and disappeared for days. Mm-hmm. I know the incident isn't covered during the time period of this book.
No, I refer to it in little bits because where it's relevant. Yes, that's right. It's what used to be called a nervous breakdown, I suppose. I was in this play and we'd just done the last series of A Bit of Fry and Laurie. Hugh and I just finished that series. I had been rehearsing the play. I had promised a friend that I would do the narration for Peter and the Wolf on the Sunday, which I did, and in a church. She was a musician, and I did the narration, which was a fun gig. And then I got home, and I thought I wanted to kill myself. And I went down and
Do you have any reason,
garage.
Or is it just a feeling?
No, it was just a feeling,
depression.
An absolute feeling. It was total depression. It's just a feeling that I really, really had no desire whatever to live. And I went so far as to go down to the car in the garage and put my hand on the ignition key. And again, it sounds so sentimental, but the image of my parents came into my head, and I just thought, I can't. I cannot do that to them.
You couldn't disappoint them.
It's not more than disappoint. I mean, how would they take the news that their son killed himself? How would any parent? I mean, and it's a thing I deal with a lot now because I'm president of Britain's largest mental health charity. I'm also an honorary fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, and I do a lot of work in mental health when I can. I don't presume to be an expert, but I, as someone who's had mental health issues, I think the raising of the stigma and the talking about it is incredibly important. It's important also to make the distinction that it's not just an attribute of creative minds, and it's a sort of rather wonderful thing like drugs. It mostly affects and mostly afflicts the those at the very bottom rung of society. They're the ones who need the most help, as is true of drugs and any other thing. So, I know there are a lot of famous, dancers, singers, actors, musicians, whatever, who talk about their bipolar disorder as they talk about their drug addiction. It's almost as if it's a designer handbag to them. On the one hand, one wants to be able to say you can function with bipolar disorder. You can be function very well.
Especially during the manic periods.
Well, yes. Or you can be someone like Redfield Jameson, who is the who wrote that book, An Unquiet Mind, and she is the professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University, which most people would agree is the greatest teaching hospital in the world. And she is the author of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on it. And she's on the highest dose of lithium imaginable.
Graham Greene said that he couldn't write until he found lithium.
That's right. And also, just to add, while W.H. Auden's great remark, don't take away my devils because you'll take away my angels too.
I want to touch on another thing. Did you come along at the right time? Because alternative comedy, I don't know exactly what we could call it, became the rage in England, first with Beyond the Fringe around 1960. Then there were the Pythons. There were the Goon Show even earlier.
Yeah.
And
graduate years. We were very lucky. it's a slightly different. It's a boring English class distinction, I suppose you'd have to call it. The goons were ex-soldiers from the Second World War who were more or less pretty much working class, ordinary, non-university educated people. Harry Secombe, Spike Milligan, Peter Sellers, who of course became a great, great film star and comedian, and Spike Milligan wrote them all. They were huge influence on a university generation that included people like Peter Cook and John Cleese. And they then created this tradition with Python and various other things, which is what was called graduate humour. Hugh and I thought the door was shutting in our face because alternative comedy was ordinary people who had not gone to university necessarily doing stand-up. Stand-up clubs had arrived in America, like Caroline's and Catch a Rising Star and things like that, had become big in America in the sort of just post-John Belushi period of towards the mid-70s and late 70s. They're really beginning to catch on, this whole idea that there was a circuit. And what the comedy Hugh and I did was sketch comedy. You know, knock, 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 oh, come in, Perkins, sit down, and there would be an amusing scene. Whereas the comedy that was really catching fire was a tortured individual with a microphone.
Or he says, okay, who's from Brooklyn?
Yeah, or that's when it began to get cheap and sad. But there were some great men. I mean, there were some extraordinary men, Sam Kennison, the people like that. I mean, some of them very angry, some of them with really good things to say, some of them with, you know, quite clear political agendas, some of them with, Emo Phillips, just sort of weird personalities. But now, of course, it has become like lounge singing. There are cliches who just so... Just as you say, who's from Brooklyn, or they say, coffee. What's all that about? Just really terrible, terrible.
So when is the next book? We have very little time. When's the next book coming out?
Well, who knows? I've got to live a little bit first. I'll probably write it next year.
Live a little bit?
Or the year after. In the meantime, I'm doing The Hobbit, and I've just done the Sherlock Holmes film.
Any more novels? You've written four novels on top of everything
else.
Well,
that's the thing. I might write a novel and then another volume of autobiography. Don't bother the public even more.
His latest book is The Fry Chronicles. We didn't cover everything. We didn't cover any of the sex, Stephen. I'm
no,
so sorry.
So
we'll have to
deal
with that.
Yeah.
Deal with that the next time
we'll
we come
We'll have sex
by.
Later, Leonard. Yeah.
Okay. The book is published. Did I say okay? The book is published by Overlook.
Did.